The comments and views expressed on The More Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Moore, The More Show, or this radio station and its affiliates or sponsors.
I'm Kevin Moore, and you're now listening to The More Show. For the next hour, I'll cover subjects of an alternative variety that most shows do not touch. On today's show, I'm joined by Bruce Rux to discuss his book, Hollywood vs. the Aliens. So stay tuned, enjoy, and I'll be right back with Bruce.
Mr. Show or a guest, want to know more about The More Show and upcoming guests? Then log on to www.themoreshow.co.uk.
Listening to The More Show,
And here's your host, Kevin Moore.
Welcome back to the show. We're about to be joined by our guest, Bruce Rux. Well, just a bit of background on Bruce. He was an actor for 20 years and holds an MA in Mass Communications. Bruce has studied ufology his entire life. After the Mars Observer probe failure in 93, Bruce wrote to share his findings with several researchers in the field and decided to write a book containing the results of his own UFO research and conclusions. This resulted in the book Unriddling Atlantis and Anomalies of Mars. The following year, he wrote a companion volume that turned out to be even a more massive success, Hollywood vs. the Aliens, the Motion Pictures Industry's Participation in UFO Disinformation. Well, Bruce is here now to discuss this book. Bruce, welcome to the show.
Well, nice to be here.
Now, Bruce, just tell me a bit about your book, Hollywood vs. the Aliens.
Hollywood vs. the Aliens was actually a sequel to Architects of the Underworld. Architects of the Underworld was my first book. Hollywood vs. the Aliens was a sequel to it. Originally, it started out as a three-chapter appendix to the first book, which just talked about how there were intelligence connections in Hollywood and how they manipulated public perceptions of UFOs, among other things. UFOs was just the bottom edge of the iceberg, really. They manipulate all kinds of things, political perceptions in all sorts of ways. But UFOs, plainly, if you understand anything about them, this was the most important thing that they were manipulating as far as perceptions went, because it's the top secret. Anyway, it started out as those three chapters. When I finally got a publisher, he said, well, you know, you should really make a second book out of this. And I didn't think that I could. But lo and behold, I worked on it for about a year, and ended up being considerably longer than my first book.
So, Bruce, how did you get involved in ufology?
I've been studying UFOs my entire life, really, since I was a kid. I mean, I grew up watching the original Outer Limits and Star Trek back in the 1960s, and I was very interested in whatever the reality might be behind those shows. So I read whatever I could find on the subject, which was usually paperback original stuff, and sometimes I'd even find them thrown away. They were very, very cheap things back then, you know, like 25-cent books that people would buy at 7-Eleven, and no one took seriously. But they were written by guys like Major Donald E. Kehoe. He was a United States Marine Corps major. And, you know, he wasn't any slough. He knew his stuff. He'd done a lot of research, and he knew a lot of stuff that was going on inside the government. They didn't share a whole lot of information with him, but the point was he was an insider, and he was able to pick a few things up. So I was reading their kind of material, and just over the years, it wasn't a steady thing for me. I mean, it wasn't something that I was studying every day or that I was obsessed with. Just when I found information on it, I would do some research. And over the years, I finally formulated a theory which I believe is correct. It's rather complex. I mean, it's not just a simple thing. Well, it's this. There's quite a bit to it, but I believe I've got it correct. And then I started noticing in the movies how I would find some of the same information popping out. And then I'd say, well, how could that possibly be? This is accurate information. You get it from documents, for instance, like from the Cause case, the Citizens Against UFO Secrecy. They brought a massive lawsuit against the government to bring a bunch of documents out. And all the various agencies involved first had denied that they had any interest in the subject. Then they denied that they had any documents. Then when they were forced to admit that they had documents, they refused to release them. When they were forced legally to release them, they blacked them out as heavily as they possibly could and got rid of as many as they could. And the point was that what was in those documents that they were so reluctant to part with, it was showing up in these movies and TV shows and such, you know, years before anyone was supposed to have known about this. But then if you research who was making those things, you'll find that they've got government connections. They've got connections with military intelligence. They've got connections with government people. And, you know, it starts falling into place pretty quick.
Yeah. What's the difference, Bruce, between misinformation and disinformation?
Misinformation is really very clever. That's where you take accurate information and you seed it out of a completely unbelievable source. For instance, if I were to lay out actual Iraqi war plans on something like Gilligan's Island, no one would believe it. They'd hear it and they'd just laugh it off and it would immediately be dismissed out of their mind. Disinformation, on the other hand, is where you take a credible source or someone who should be credible. Someone like General Philip Corso, for instance, who was a government insider. He wrote the book The Day After Roswell. Well, most of that book is just pure hooey, and he knew it when he was writing it. He was doing it as a government, as a friendly gesture for the government. They asked him to do it, and he did it, in order to attract a lot of attention and dismiss a lot of attention.
Okay.
It brings the kooks out of the woodwork, and the serious people are looking at it and saying, oh, this just isn't true, because they're checking what he has to say, and what he has to say doesn't add up. But he is a legitimate general, and he has been working inside the government. I mean, his credentials are solid, so you have to wonder, why is he lying? Any intelligent person is going to know he's lying, because they're going to check out what he's saying. But the average guy, they're just going to accept what he has to say, even when he contradicts himself, as he will do multiple times. And he does it on purpose in order to trip people up. That's disinformation.
So, I mean, has the UFO lie been covered up since the first atomic bomb?
I'm quite convinced that at least the major world governments, I would say that Britain, definitely Germany, and the United States have been aware of UFOs for a very long time, I mean, probably well before World War II. But certainly in the United Kingdom, especially in Britain, the Royal Society, for instance, was investigating UFOs and strange lights on the moon and things that were moving around in space and on other planets way back over 150, 160 years ago. They gave up trying to catalog them on the moon, as a matter of fact, because there were just too many of them. So they've been aware of something out there for a long time, I'm quite sure. But
yeah.
Certainly with Roswell, the lid was off the subject behind the scenes, and they had to put the lid on the subject in front of the scenes because it got exposed too early. Some well-meaning people at the base came across the wreckage, recognized that it was not anything that came from us or from the Russians, and said so. They said straight up, look, this came from out there. And the FBI had to call the station and put the kibosh on it. Say, look, this is top secret sensitive information. We can't do any of this yet. And the next thing you know, it became a weather balloon.
Yeah.
So certainly from Roswell on, we've known that, yes, there was someone else out there. And we assembled a team behind the scenes to figure out exactly who it was and what was going on.
Why, in your opinion, do you think they were so scared of Roswell?
Well, look at it this way. We get to the end of World War II, which was a pretty major deal, and we're far enough away from it now that there are a lot of people who really don't have a concept of just how serious World War II was. It was called a world war for a reason. Everybody was involved. A lot of people died. The atomic bomb came out of World War II. The atomic bomb is pretty damn scary still, and here we are at the one base in the entire world that has a working atomic bomb. In fact, it had two. This did not come out until about the time that I was writing my first book. And I was the first person that actually put it out where everyone would catch it. I got it out of a UFO magazine from some very good researchers who had figured this out. Now, they talked to the people who said, oh yeah, we had working atomic bombs there. Well, there are only two working atomic bombs in the world. Something shows up in our airspace that we can't identify, piloted by, to all appearances, by some kind of automata or robots, which indicates that whoever it was that sent this is not from our planet. They don't have to come here in person. They know that we have atomic bombs, and they are doing something with them. That would be pretty scary. We're at the end of World War II, and there's a power that's greater than either us or the Russians or anybody else. So they got scared. They needed to know exactly who it was that was out there and what they were doing.
So is that part of the reason why the UFO subjects are ridiculed?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
That's just one. There are all kinds of different reasons. It's sort of like the government's war at any given time. Ask anyone why we're in that war, and they'll give you their own reason for why we're there. They've all got a reason they want to be there. One reason is that they're afraid of letting the information out. You can't let your populace know that there is someone else in your airspace. In other words, that it's not your airspace. Someone else can traverse this area anytime they like, and they are superior to us. You don't want to advertise that. That pulls your pants down and doesn't make you look good. You also don't want to advertise to any foreign powers, say the Russians, the Chinese, whoever else might be in the game, that you have acquired some superior technology from elsewhere. You want to keep that secret so that you can exploit it in quiet without anybody realizing where you're getting your technological edge. Those are just a couple of the reasons right off the top of my head. The third, and this would be where fear for public opinion and all that would come in, is if you recognize that these guys were not just monkeying around with your superior technology, at least on this planet, but they're also involved in other activities, such as picking up some of the locals, engaging in sexual activity with them, getting offspring, which they're taking somewhere else, performing invasive surgery, performing mind control on them for purposes that we're not fully aware of the reasons why. Yeah, that would be something that you would have an immense amount of difficulty trying to explain to the populace.
Yeah, but Bruce, but I mean, surely space just makes good movies, doesn't it? I mean, are you saying that you know, UFOs have always been seeded in movies? And if so, what is that reason for?
Well, they knew that they were not going to be able to keep the subject secret forever. That just wasn't going to happen. On the other hand, they also knew they had to keep it secret. In 1953, the CIA assembled the Robertson Panel, which was their hand-picked bunch of scientists, to look over a hand-picked bunch of cases that were straw dogs that they could easily shoot down and say, well, see, there's nothing to this. However, behind the scenes, they made recommendations, which we have. We have the documents, saying to the government that what they should do is exactly what I'm talking about in Hollywood versus the Aliens. They recommended Walt Disney by name for putting out information on UFOs or disinformation on UFOs. And they also talked about possibly putting in some more accurate information for future reference. In other words, that as years went by, people could begin to learn a little bit about it, because it was not going to be able, they weren't going to be able to keep it secret forever. That just wasn't going to happen.
Okay. I mean, can you go back before Roswell? I mean, what about the Orson Welles publicity stunt? I mean, is that connected with the UFO?
That's a very good question. I would like to have the answer to that one myself. The thing with Orson Welles, first off, you have to understand he was very much a showman, and he was very much a government-friendly guy, at least when it came to FDR. He campaigned for FDR's controversial fourth re-election term. He was with him the whole way. They were friends. They knew each other. So, with this in mind, a couple of things come up with, say, War of the Worlds. The first thing that would immediately spring to mind is, if FDR wanted to test the waters for getting into World War II, he might do it with something like War of the Worlds, just to see what kind of reaction people would have to being attacked, for instance. Say, you know, are they going to get behind it? Are they going to be afraid? What? You know, let's test the waters. So it's quite possible that FDR could have asked Orson Welles to do something like War of the Worlds for exactly that reason. It's also possible that Orson would have wanted to do it solely as a publicity stunt, which worked. They got him a lot of publicity and, you know, put his name even better on the map. I think there's probably a little bit more to it than that, but I can't be absolutely certain. And that is that if the government already had some knowledge that there was someone else out there, and there are reasons to believe that they might have, prior to the War of the Worlds broadcast, at the turn of the century, Nikola Tesla was convinced that he had received intelligence signals from Mars. And everybody laughed at him when he finally came out and said that, except Lord Kelvin, who came over from Britain and said he agreed with him. And after that, you never heard another thing about it. There were a couple of experiments with an advanced radio telescope done with the U.S. Navy to receive signals from Mars on days of observed radio silence that did yield results and even yielded a voice message, which was never translated. We never understood what it meant. But these things did happen back at the turn of the century and in the 1920s. So there is reason to believe that, you know, by the 1938 broadcast of War of the Worlds, yes, the government might have had some idea that there was someone out there and that they were from Mars. And maybe they wanted to test the waters and say, well, what do you think?
Right.
And tossed War of the Worlds out there as an experiment. It has been used ever since as the excuse for keeping it secret, because they say, oh, look at the panic that was caused by that particular broadcast. Well, of course it was a panic caused by that broadcast. You told everyone that they were being vaporized by heat rays. Naturally, they were going to be a little frightened. And possibly that was the reason that it was put out also, was as an excuse to keep a lid down on what they were finding out. Now, I can't prove any of that. That is speculation, and those are the reasons that I do speculate it.
Okay.
We do know that Orson Welles made the show as realistic as he possibly could, despite CBS coming down on him and saying, look, this is too realistic, you need to tone it down, put in some fake names. And he would say, okay, I'll do that. And then he'd submit them something with the fake names, and the second their back was turned, he'd switch it right back to the real place names. He'd even done research, actually, at Grover's Mill, where the main action was set when the Martians first land. So he was definitely trying to make it as realistic as possible. Whatever the exact reason for that was, we can speculate, but he was definitely doing it.
That's why Mars featured predominantly in a lot of the early Hollywood films then.
Oh, I think so, yes. I believe, actually, that Mars is an inhabited planet, or at least that it is a way station of some sort for whoever it is that's coming here into our airspace. I believe it has been since antiquity. As a matter of fact, I believe the human race migrated here from Mars. It's in our mythologies. That's what my entire first book was about. I believe the government became rather aware of that sometime around 1900, or about the time Nikola Tesla was paying attention. They were at least investigating it, and as I said, the British Royal Society had been investigating some extraterrestrial activity prior to that. Now, there were several instances of it, or things that would link to extraterrestrial activity, let's put it that way.
Okay.
So, yeah, I believe they were aware, and certainly by the time Roswell came along, they started putting their facts together really fast, figured out that it came from Mars. Their assessment, the military assessment, they were the ones that were given the job of figuring all of this out, the U.S. Army Air Corps. Their own assessment was that it came either from Venus or Mars, most likely, with the best candidate being Mars. And that was actually in Project Sign in their documents, which they declassified and ordered burned, which, standing contradiction right there, you wouldn't need to burn something that was declassified, anyone could read it.
Sure.
But they ordered it declassified and then burned. But some documents survived, and we've got them, you know, into today.
You've speculated there that Walt Disney was involved in the intelligence community, but how did the intelligence community get to the studios? I mean, was it through the directors or the writers?
It was at the top, mostly from the producers. Roger Corman, for instance. Now, understand, I can't, you know, produce a document saying, hello, this guy belonged to the CIA. I can't do that. What I can do is show you a background that ties directly into intelligence work, to military work and intelligence work. With a couple of people in particular, say, like Leslie Stevens, who produced the original Outer Limits and a number of other things. He's also the guy who introduced Stanley Kubrick to Hollywood. The other one, Roger Corman. Roger Corman is one of those guys in Hollywood who you can play the seven steps of Kevin Bacon with, only it's more like two steps of Roger Corman. Everyone who got their start in Hollywood got their start through Roger Corman one way or another. Roger Corman, they knew someone who knew Roger Corman, and he got practically everybody their start. And just about anyone in Hollywood will tell you that.
Okay. I mean, has there been many stories in Hollywood about how scripts have been changed over the years?
There have been a few, none with like overt pressure, someone saying, well, you have to do this. But if you take something like The Thing from Another World, which was the first real flying saucer movie, that particular story was written by John W. Campbell back in the pulp days in the 1930s for, I don't remember which one it was, Amazing Stories or something like that. Weird Tales, maybe, I don't remember which one. But anyhow, they took his story and adapted it into what amounts to a retelling of the Roswell story, with just a slight tweak to it, and setting it in the Arctic instead of setting it in the desert. In both cases, you've got a desert, but it's, you know, different between the heat and the cold. Otherwise, it's pretty much the same story. You have a craft that comes down out of the sky. It's perceived to be a meteorite, but it changes direction. They recognize that it's not a meteorite.
Yeah.
They go to the location. They find a crashed ship. The ship itself is destroyed. There's at least one occupant inside that is intact. The occupant is bulletproof, blastproof, flameproof. They can't destroy it. And they finally have to destroy it with electricity, which, I don't know, if you were talking about something like a robot, an overload of electricity might just take it out. They seem to be taking basically Roswell facts and simply transporting them to the Arctic. So when it came to making the monster for that particular piece, in the original story, this thing was a shape-shifting entity. It could become anything that it wanted to become. Now, originally, when they wrote the script, they tried to do that. And John Carpenter did do that when he did the remake in 1982 or 83. Might have even been 84, I have to remember now. He actually did do a lot of some expensive special effects for the shape-shifting. But when they wrote the script, that kept going up to the producer, and it would come back down the chain, and they'd say, well, we need to change the monster. Well, it's too difficult. Well, we need to change the monster. And what they finally ended up with was James Arness looking kind of like the Frankenstein monster. He just had a big bald head and kind of big spiky hands. And otherwise, he was just kind of a big humanoid, really. He looked sort of like the Frankenstein monster in the original 1930s production.
Yeah.
And that's one of those ways where they changed the what was going on in the movie to match more closely UFO facts. Because in essence, what he looked like was a UFO gray. Big bald head and great big eyes. They described as having eyes that don't seem to blink, and they just stare right at you. And when you first see it through the eyes, it looks very much like a UFO gray, if you actually go back and look at the movie itself. That would be one of those instances where something was being changed on the production level for not a stated reason. I mean, not the stated reason that we need to do this, make it look more like actual UFO facts. But if you look at it years later, knowing actual UFO facts, you can see that that's probably what the reason was.
The UFO community have not got on board the robot idea, yet the movie studios have always represented the UFO films with a robot there.
Yes, exactly. Robots and mind control and Mars are almost universal in early flying saucer movies. They're almost always associated with Mars. They are always associated with mind control and with sabotage, sometimes up to assassination, and they almost always include robots or creatures that could very easily be interpreted as robots. Even more to the point, most of those robots look like we describe UFO grays today. Now, they've usually got the bald heads, the big unblinking bug eyes, and you know they do the overpowering mind control thing. You are in our power, you cannot resist us, you will forget this, all of that. Which, in later UFO abduction reports, has been universal. Long before Bud Hopkins was reporting any of this, and when there were even independent researchers that got some of their information put out in paperback originals like I was talking about earlier. Now, they all referred to the same thing, which was that mind control was employed. Memories were erased.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, it's all still in there, but we don't understand hypnosis as well as the guys that were doing this, which is one of the things the government was working on, trying to figure this out, the whole mind control thing, MKUltra, all of that. But you'll find that universally in the movies all the way from the start.
So what do you think about the Outer Limits or the alien abductions? I mean, was the Outer Limits CIA-driven, do you think?
Absolutely. The executive producer of that show was Leslie Stevens, who I brought up earlier. This guy was very, very well connected. He came from a straight military background. In World War II and after, he was stationed in Iceland, I believe it was, with the United States Air Force. His father was a vice admiral who was responsible for defecting Russians. And when Russians came over here, this was the guy who handled them. He was also the guy who created airplane arresting gear for aircraft carriers. In other words, he was very hooked up with the government, as tied in as you could get. And Leslie Stevens was also his son. Leslie worked for Time magazine, which was started by the CIA. He worked at a mental hospital for a brief time, which shows up in one of the episodes. He had basically CIA fingerprints all over his resume and his background. And if you look at The Outer Limits itself, this was a completely unique show in television history. It was almost entirely about UFO abductions.
Yeah.
UFO abductions and first contact scenarios. There were very few exceptions to those two kinds of stories, and the vast majority of them were about abductions. No one was talking about abductions in 1963. It just wasn't discussed. There had been one case that was on record before that, and that was Antonio Villas-Boas in 1957, but his case was kind of shunted off to the side in Flying Saucer Review, even though it had been paid serious attention by the Brazilian Air Force. It was in Brazil. It was not seriously paid attention to any place else. It didn't get major coverage. And here we have The Outer Limits, where every week I've got some big, bald-headed, bug-eyed alien, which are frequently acting like robots or have the attributes of robots, picking somebody up, taking them away someplace, and doing whatever with them. You have reproduction-type episodes. You have just any kind of scenario you can imagine with UFO abduction. It's there. People are being abducted. And again, back then, no one was talking about such things.
That's right.
It just was not discussed.
That's right. I mean, if you go back to the 1960s, I mean, look at Doctor Who and Star Trek. I mean, they were two iconic episodes that launched at sort of around the same time. I mean, do you think there was any influence from outside people there? Any shadowy people that influenced these subjects, these shows?
Yes, and I wish I could give you more names or more proof. I did not find this out until after my book went to press, and I can't remember his name now, but I read an article that revealed it. The same person that came up with the Avengers in Britain also came up with Doctor Who. He was the mastermind behind both of those. Now, he gave those to other producers to flesh out and do what they would with, but they did come from the BBC behind the scenes, I mean, but from the same guy. In both of these shows, you will find accurate UFO material, which I find extremely interesting. Now, for instance, in The Avengers, you have the Cybernauts. And what are the Cybernauts? Well, first off, why call them Cybernauts? That's just an awful strange thing to call them. Cyber makes sense, because that relates to a robot. But what does not mean? The not means something that voyages. Well, where's the thing voyaging to? All it is it's a robot with a Homburg hat put on and a big black overcoat, and is programmed to go out and kill people, which it does very efficiently. It's kind of a guided missile. But it looks just like a UFO gray. It's got this blank etched face with the kind of almond-shaped eyes, a bald head, and the only difference is that it's enormously taller. Grays are usually reported as being very short. But it's a UFO gray. And what's it doing in the Avengers? Well, because someone would do something about it, that's why. And then Doctor Who, and Doctor Who is loaded with robots. There were more automata in Doctor Who than I could possibly catalog. He even had a robot assistant, K-9, his dog. Robots were all over the place, and so were alien abductions. Those happened quite a bit, too, especially with the Master. The Master, who is kind of the Doctor's opposite, he's from the same race, but he's definitely of a different mindset. The Master abducts people, hypnotizes them, mind controls them, uses them for his purposes, and erases their memory of the fact. All of this stuff ties straight into UFO information. And again, from behind the scenes, they came from the same guy, whose name I can't remember, but there was one producer in particular who, or one guy at the BBC at the executive level who said, you know, this would be a good idea for a show. And sure enough, people took them and ran off with them, and that's what they became. And in the case of Star Trek is just, it's a global industry and has been for decades now. I cannot prove any particular behind-the-scenes connections with Gene Roddenberry, except one. And that is that he was the personal protege of the head of the LAPD back in the 1960s. They were very, very tight. And he went from being in the LAPD and being the chosen successor of the head of the LAPD. He instead went into Hollywood and produced Star Trek. Star Trek is loaded with accurate UFO information, which I think anyone, if they expose themselves to UFO information and watch Star Trek, they'll catch it. It's all over the place. And there were many different kinds of episodes that, like Doctor Who, were trying to prove Arthur C. Clarke's dictum that if technology is superior enough, it just looks like magic. In other words, when the Enterprise would encounter a primitive civilization, that primitive civilization could be one very much like our very own.
Yeah.
At the time that we were watching that show. And so here we're getting the idea of a federation out there with people just like us, but their technology is so advanced that they seem like magic to us. And we kind of get to put the shoe on the other foot and see how it would be for them to interact with us.
Bruce, we need to take a break there, so stay tuned and we'll be right back.
To connect with the show, email kevin@themoreshow.co.uk.
Make a
You're listening to The Moore Show, and here's your host, Kevin Moore.
Welcome back to the show. I'm currently joined here with our guest, Bruce Rux. Bruce, just before the break there, we were discussing Gene Roddenberry. Did Gene have an interest in ufology? Did he believe in UFOs?
Overtly, no. In fact, he poo-pooed the subject overtly. And yet, you'll see certain episodes, like Tomorrow is Yesterday, where the Enterprise goes back into the 1960s to our time, is perceived as a UFO, is pursued by a pilot whose plane disintegrates, and they have some problems, which is the exact same story that you get from the Captain Mantell case in 1948. Captain Mantell was in a P-51 squadron that went after a UFO over an airbase, whose plane disintegrated and crashed, and he ended up being decapitated because he pursued the object too high. He described the object as metallic and enormous in size, plainly artificial, and he and his squadron all went after it, but the rest of them turned back. And he kept going and did not have the new oxygen masks that the other craft had in his craft. He thought he could do it and he couldn't. Apparently passed out and crashed. Well, just about all those particulars show up in this particular Star Trek episode. So plainly Roddenberry knew something about it. And where publicly if someone asked him about UFOs or what he thought about them, he would say, oh, well, I think it's all nonsense. And professed to not have any interest. But I believe behind the scenes, the reality, just by demonstration of his work, was considerably different.
Yeah. I mean, tell me about Gene and the Nine.
Oh, the Nine. Well, yeah, that's quite a story. I don't have all the names in place. Now, these are some things that you'll have to look up yourself. I do know that Roddenberry got mixed up with the Nine. And no one knows who the Nine are, first off. This is some shadowy group, a very wealthy shadowy group, with some connections in, they definitely have some connections in Canada, and they've probably got them a few other places, too. So no one knows why there are all these very wealthy people behind the scenes attached to it. The Bronfmans, for instance, in Canada, they're booze magnates. They are partly connected to this. Anyway, Roddenberry was at a racetrack, and he was kind of depressed at the time because none of his shows were doing well. Star Trek was really the only successful show he had until way late in his life. He put out all kinds of pilots, and they just didn't go anywhere. And he met some race car driver who said, you know, you might be interested in meeting these guys and talking to some of these people who know the Nine. He said, what's the Nine? He said, well, I'll introduce you. So he gets brought into some kind of group, you know, in a very nice place, some fancy, expensive chalet, and everyone's sort of informal, but they're eating, you know, very expensive food, and they've got lots of caviar around and all this type of thing.
Yeah.
And the story that he gets is that the Nine, the original creator gods from ancient Egypt, and this much is true, this is all part of Egyptian mythology, but anyone could look this up, they're saying that the Nine original creator gods are channeled through some of their gifted psychics, and that they can pick up some information from them. So Roddenberry was invited to come and listen to some of the channelings of the Nine, and he was not a stupid man. He recognized that he asked some of the right questions in order to try and trip up whoever it was if it was a sham. They were putting on a good show, and he never came out and said that he thought they were a sham, but it kind of shows him what he was doing. And yet, he did name one of his TV shows Deep Space Nine, and the influence of the Nine does show up in some of his later shows.
Okay.
He didn't stay with them very long, because it was evident to him that something was a little off with them. He might ask them, well, if you are disembodied intelligences and the original creator gods of ancient Egypt, why do you need some kind of metal ships in order to come here? And he'd get a nice evasive answer like, well, we are disembodied intelligences, but some of the races that we contact need to move through some of these kind of vessels. Oh, okay. So there's a lot of that going on. And plainly it had some kind of influence on his shows. You can see it in, like I just mentioned, with Deep Space Nine and a couple of other things. There was one original Star Trek episode that you'd... and this is interesting because it happened before he met the Nine, theoretically. So I don't know if they were taking their cue off of him or vice versa or how that went. But he had an episode where the Enterprise came across three globes containing the disembodied intelligences of the original creator gods of planet Earth. And they ask to temporarily use the bodies of some of the Enterprise crew. Then they sort of reenact Osiris and Isis and Set for everybody, which was a pretty good episode. But it's interesting that the Nine kind of picked up on that and then turned it back around on Roddenberry. So all the particulars of this, I couldn't really tell you.
Sure.
It's a fascinating story. I do know some books are being written about it, which I'm looking forward to reading myself. And by the way, one of the main producers in the entire Stargate franchise, I can't think of his name either, which one it is, but the guy who came up with Stargate, I don't think it was Roland Emmerich, but it was someone directly associated with him, is also a devotee of the Nine, or had been attached to the Nine at some time or another.
Now, another fantastic sci-fi series that I used to love to watch when I was younger was The X-Files. Now, would you say that The X-Files had accurate information in, or was it a lot of debunk?
The X-Files is very scattershot. I don't know what to make of that show myself. It does have some episodes with some rather accurate information in it. It's also got a number of episodes that are just a bunch of kind of homemade hooey. They go pretty much all over the board. For instance, they had one show with aliens that are able to... They serial murder people, and then they change from male to female, and then back from female to male. Which, no, there's absolutely nothing like that anywhere, remotely in UFO lore. And I don't know where they came up with it. I suppose it's kind of entertaining in its own weird way. And yet, at the same time, you'll find they have quite a few episodes where there is a bit of accurate information put in, or stuff that's much closer to the bone, let's say. For instance, they had one with people apparently being killed by cockroaches, but they're not cockroaches, they're actually robots. And the robots appear to be probe devices, picking up information that someone else then picks them up and takes them back where they came from.
Yeah.
But no one knows who made them. Well, that ties straight into the UFO stuff. Not the robots murdering people, but the fact that robots coming from another planet are used as surveillance devices, and that is actually mentioned in the episode. It's a plot point. So you'll find a mix. There's some accurate stuff, some inaccurate stuff. What's most interesting about that particular show, it came out right at the start of the Clinton administration. Usually, this is not an ironclad rule, but usually you will find more interesting or intelligent or evocative question-asking shows about UFOs coming out during Democratic administrations and more shoot-em-ups coming out, good guys, bad guys, white hats, black hats, out of Republican administrations. There are exceptions, but it's a general rule.
Yeah.
We were talking about The Outer Limits and Star Trek. Those both came out during Democratic administrations, during Kennedy and Johnson. And I believe the same was going on over in England at the time. You'd have to correct me on that, because I'm thinking off the top of my head, and I can't remember. Now, The X-Files should have failed. It got very low ratings. It was contracted for 13 episodes. It bombed. No one was watching it. But the next thing you know, Fox decided to renew it and finish out the season and do another 13 episodes, or however many it was, for no known reason. They just said, well, we're going to back this and make this go. The next thing you know, got a major publicity thrust. It started winning Golden Globes and being on the cover of TV Guide. It just got this massive publicity thrust. And the next thing you know, it was a 10-year hit. You can ask yourself what the reasons are for that, but plainly somebody was backing it.
Okay, well, one of my next questions, Bruce, is we mentioned Stanley Kubrick before in the interview. What's Stanley Kubrick's story?
Yes. Kubrick was basically introduced to the Hollywood community through Leslie Stevens, who we talked about earlier. About the time that he had been doing some independent work, which was pretty impressive, and this was noticed by Leslie Stevens, among other people, who introduced him to some people at United Artists, where he got his start. Kubrick obviously went on to do 2001, which his entire life changed when he did 2001, 1968. He spent, I think, 4 years making that movie, something in that neck of the woods, during which he became the Stanley Kubrick that we recognize popularly today. Before, he was a clean-shaven, driven man who did excellent work, I think. And in fact, I think his best work was done in that early phase. But while he was making 2001, he sort of mutated into the Stanley Kubrick we all recognize today, the overweight, bearded, manic-eyed, crazy, obsessive guy. Now, there has been a theory for a long time that the moonshots were faked, or at least what we saw on TV was faked. And if that was the case, that Stanley Kubrick would have been a good candidate for the person to have done it. My argument against that has always been, well, I would think he would do a better job. considering that what came out of 2001 looked just incredible, and what we saw on TV looked, I don't know, pretty crappy. However, there have been some researchers over the years, and I wish I could think of their names off the top of my head. I've picked up some of their information, and I don't want to be stealing their thunder. As a matter of fact, I hope that they write books on this, because I would like to read them. I've only read articles to date, but I find them to be very interesting. If you take some of Kubrick's later movies, there are some clues to indicate that he may have been involved in faking what we saw on TV for the moonshots. That doesn't mean that we didn't go to the moon. It doesn't mean that we did either. What it means is that we saw on TV was not legitimate. That was fake. That was studio shot. One of the things that does show up, if you take a look at all the moonshots, you'll see a demarcation line toward the back. A demarcation line where you have a landscape that goes on beyond it, but you can see a sort of a line that breaks it. And you'll find that in all of the shots. Well, that line is something that Kubrick came up with in 2001. That's where you do your blue screen, basically, with the rear projection. And when you might, I don't know if you're familiar with Richard Hoagland. Hoagland got way off base trying to talk about these glass cities on the moon. And he got that by showing these pictures that had been light blasted that seemed to show what looked like a regular grid or trellis work in the background. He said, well, this is like a glass city. See, you can see it here when you light blast the picture. No, but if you light blast the picture and you see that grid, what it is little bitty tiny glass beads. Those little bitty tiny glass beads are what Stanley Kubrick came up with for his screens, which is, in other words, a way of saying that it is possible that when you light blast those images and you see that particular thing, you are seeing the glass beads of Stanley Kubrick's backshot curtain. This is actually a very lengthy and in-depth topic, and I'm not sure that I could do it justice in a short period of time. We can suffice it to say that there are some interesting clues in Kubrick's life that would indicate that he might have been involved in this kind of project. One in particular, he insisted in his will, because he died before Eyes Wide Shut came out, but he insisted on its release date being what its release date was, which was an unusual release date, just as far as the week went. It happens to be the day that we launched to the moon for Apollo 11. So, just one of many curious coincidences.
Strange, isn't it? Yeah, because it's...
I don't know whether or not this is true. I do know it's very interesting. And if anyone was going to do something like that, Kubrick would be the guy that would. I just tossed that out for interest's sake.
Yeah, I mean, I found Kubrick's last movie, Eyes Wide Shut, I mean, I found it fascinating. It was like a kind of look at the Illuminati, in a sense. It was a very strange film, but, I mean, one that, you know, I could watch again and again. But, I mean, what do you think?
I love that movie.
Hmm.
I had heard it speculated in my last interview, as a matter of fact. Someone had said that maybe Kubrick was killed because of what he put out in Eyes Wide Shut. I wouldn't think that. I might think it possible that he could have been because of being involved in the moon stuff and trying to put information out on it when he shouldn't have been. I don't think that is the case, but if that were, I mean, if he had been taken out by somebody by nefarious means, that would probably be a likelier reason. As far as what Kubrick was trying to get at in Eyes Wide Shut specifically, we're never really going to know.
No.
Because we are never going to see his cut. And the studio recut his film after he died and released it when they had to, but they did their own cut, and we don't know what all Kubrick had there. They must have cut an hour out of that movie, which I would dearly love to see. I happen to love Eyes Wide Shut. I think it's a very good movie.
Yeah.
It's very misunderstood. People give it bad marks for a number of different reasons, but they're not watching the movie for what it is. I think it's very, very well done. As far as the secret society business, I've heard all kinds of things speculated. Could be any number of different things. What it is specifically is really unimportant. What he's getting at is the secrets of the halls of power and what goes on behind the scenes. And that, I think, he portrays extremely well. I don't think he's looking at any particular group. He's looking at power men in general, or power people in general.
Yeah.
And does a very good job of portraying them, really.
Okay, well, let's blast forward here, and let's go to the Close Encounters film. Now, that put a very positive outlook on ufology. Now, surely Steven Spielberg must have been in the UFO loop.
Absolutely. I cannot prove that for a fact. However, I can give you some very strong circumstantial evidence. Before Close Encounters, Spielberg had put himself on the map with Jaws. That was his first big movie. He'd made a couple of good movies prior to that, which were noticed, but they were not going to put him on the map. They weren't going to make him, you know, who he is today. Jaws was the only movie that had done that. The first movie that he made after that was Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Close Encounters of the Third Kind had a budget of $20 million, which seems like nothing today. $20 million happens to be the amount of money that Jimmy Carter earmarked for UFO research, quote-unquote. Interesting coincidence. And Jimmy Carter, again, a Democratic president, and one who, unlike all other presidents, actually did say something about UFOs before he was elected. He had seen them himself when he was governor of Georgia, and even filed a report along with other witnesses. He had been asked about the subject while he was on the campaign trail, and he said he made one of his campaign promises that if he got in office, he would publicize everything that he knew about UFOs, everything the government knew about UFOs. Well, that did not happen. What we got instead was the $20 million earmarked for UFO research and a $20 million Steven Spielberg movie that happens to contain very accurate information on the UFO subject. The one thing about that, though, no one would know that that information was accurate if they hadn't done a lot of research into UFOs already. What we have are abductions taking place. They don't show the abductions, except for the overt one with Melinda Dillon's kid. And that is done in the scariest possible way. That's, you know, a genuine horror movie scene. There are no abductions on record like that. I'm not sure how that one got tossed in, probably just to keep audience interest sparked.
Yeah.
But there are no abductions like that on the record. However, we have accurate abduction information taking place in that someone sees a UFO, they have a missing time experience, they start hooking up with other people who they don't have any connection with, but they seem to know in some way. They develop strange obsessions, the government is watching them and keeps files on them, and is trying to keep them out of the loop. All of that stuff is accurate. It's completely accurate, as are some of the feats that we see the UFOs doing in the movies. Like the stuff with the air traffic controller, it's a very good scene. You want to report this as a UFO? Because they're talking about this thing coming up close to the plane. Well, that's actually happened. We have records of that. So yeah, it's a very accurate movie. And I'm quite certain that Spielberg was in on the loop. Spielberg was also a major, major, major fan of Stanley Kubrick. Before you could just go out and buy a disc and have the movie in your library, back when it was still on reels, Spielberg owned a copy of 2001, which he was famous for screening for his friends. And it's like his all-time favorite movie, that and Ben-Hur.
Yeah, I mean, look at Steven's last Indiana film. I mean, what was that about with the Mayans and the UFOs?
Yeah. That one I thought was very interesting. And you know, if they'd followed suit with what they started with, I would have just loved it. But they set it all up and then they punted it over the goalpost by saying, oh, plainly they come from another dimension. Could not possibly have to do with other planets. No, another dimension entirely. And, you know, they spun it off and kind of kicked it out of the ballpark, where they'd set it up perfectly for Mars, really, because they went with the whole 1950s angle and the Red Scare and the Russians and all of that business. And having set everything else up so perfectly, I couldn't believe they didn't finish that up and point it straight at Mars.
Yeah, I mean, other movies which stand out like the Close Encounter film, we've got to cover the Star Wars films. Do you think George was in the know with the Star Wars films at all?
Yes and no. What you find in the Star Wars movies, and here we have to differentiate them, the first Star Wars movies, the ones that were made back in the 1970s, those had a lot of very accurate mythological information in them. And the reason I bring that up is because, as I said, I believe what we're dealing with UFO intelligence is not aliens per se, but extraterrestrial humans. They were advanced in antiquity, they came to Earth, and we are them. We've just forgotten where we came from, and they remember. Now, Joseph Campbell, where he never talked about UFOs, talked about universal mythology, which is something that I've studied very thoroughly myself, and it's what my first book is largely about. Joseph Campbell and George Lucas had conferences together. They were friends. They got to know each other, and Lucas respected him tremendously. You'll find quite a lot of mythological information that is very accurate coming out in Star Wars. One of these things, like when Luke loses his hand to the lightsaber and gets a metal one in its place, the cybernetic hand, that's actually in the ancient mythology. It's one of the gods who was unable to assume kingship because you had to have an intact body, and he did not because he'd lost his hand in combat exactly that way and had to have a metal one put in his place that looked exactly like his own but was completely supple. Darth Vader, his real name is Anakin Skywalker, and Akeem is the name of a race of giants in the Bible. which you could look up yourself. Just got to go back through the Old Testament. You'll find the Anakim mentioned, the sons of Anak, A-N-A-K. And the Red Brigade that Luke joins is the Red Branch of Ulster in the Arthurian mythology, the heroic branch. And there are just a lot of mythological connections that you can find if you actually study Campbell or study a lot of mythology, and then go back and look at Lucas's films.
Now, another of my favorite sort of shows, sci-fi shows recently, has got to be Stargate and Lost. Now, where do Stargate and Lost sort of fit into the disinformation and the truth, in a sense?
Well, Stargate, like I said, one of the people in the production chain on that, very high up, was connected with the Nine, and I'm sure that he took a lot of that to heart. When I talk about the Nine, you have to understand, the Nine is definitely some kind of disinformational intelligence game. There's no question about that in my mind. However, it does have some accurate information in it, like most good disinformation does. So you will find some accurate information coming out. And in Stargate especially, once again, the movie came out during the Clinton administration, a Democratic administration. What is it about? We discover that the ancient Egyptian gods are actually extraterrestrials. And we find the planet that they came from and go to it and try to destroy them with a nuclear device. So that in the fear that they're going to come to us. And what we're doing when we do that is we're basically going back through time and seeing what our own history is in the mythology as to how the gods treated us originally. We were created to be a slave race. We were kind of kept down under their heel. Some of them took us under their wing, and we were eventually liberated. This is kind of a universal myth. You'll find it all over the world. Anyway, you have that, and that's all pretty accurate. Being shown in that movie is pretty accurate. Now, they took it a step further when they made it into a TV series in Stargate SG-1, which has been a mega success. I think it went for, 10 years, I think?
I think so.
At the time I wrote my book, it wasn't that big. The whole big franchise thing had not taken off yet. It has now. It's got a couple of different spin-off series attached to it. One of them has just started, I think. So, it's been a mega success, along the lines of Star Trek or Star Wars. It hasn't taken off quite as big as either of them, but it's much younger.
Yeah.
The point is, it definitely caught on. And it does have the accurate information in it. I don't believe there are alien parasites who are taking people over. However, you can take that as kind of a metaphor for mind control or getting inside somebody. As to whether or not they're actually attacking us, I really couldn't tell you that. I don't think so. But if someone were to say the way the Stargate does, NORAD is fully aware of this. They keep tabs on it. They have special teams that take care of it. And it's kept secret from the public. Yeah, I think every single bit of that is accurate. And it ties back into ancient Egypt and extraterrestrials. Yeah, I think that's all true.
I mean, do you believe the truth can ever be told? I mean, with the amount of pollution that's out there in the UFO field, I mean, how are they ever going to tell the truth?
They're not. They're not going to be able to. They painted themselves in a corner with us. When it will become disclosed is when the UFOs land in, Washington, D.C. and Red Square and everywhere else. When they decide to come down, then everyone's going to be rushing to the microphones to be the first ones to say, oh, yeah, we knew. See, here's all the documents we've known all along. We were just waiting for the right time to tell you. But they're not going to say anything before that because they painted themselves into a corner. In order for them to come out and talk about it now, they would be revealing all of their intelligence techniques, which they cannot afford to do. That's one of they don't like me talking about this for exactly that reason, because I'm disclosing what their intelligence techniques are when it comes down to misinformation and disinformation and Hollywood connections and all of that. Ian Fleming, by the way, in From Russia with Love, in the first part of his book, he has the head of the KGB, or Smirsch. He goes through this lengthy discussion of how the spy game goes, and one of the things he brings up is that there are people in Hollywood, in the arts, in various public businesses that put out fake information and true information, and that they come visit under the guise of just being artists, but they're really spies, and the Russians know that. And they send theirs over here, and we know that. It's exactly what I'm talking about here, but the point is that Fleming spelled it out in From Russia with Love back in 1957. I just thought it was funny.
I mean, do you ever feel that you've been allowed to write this book in a sense that, they'd rather you tell the truth than having them have to tell their own truth?
Oh, absolutely. Believe me, they were not happy when I wrote this one. They weren't happy when I wrote the first one. The second one especially, I got a lot of flack on. I got all kinds of trouble on that, which I bucked. because they pissed me off. But yeah, I did get the impression very strongly. It depends on who you believe. I have been contacted by people who I do believe. They were able to sufficiently convince me that they were telling me the truth.
Well, Bruce, look, we'd love to get you on again. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, absolutely.
To find out more information on Bruce Rux, go to my website, themoreshow.co.uk, and look up Bruce Rux under past guests. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter to get the latest updates on the shows, and that we have a national TV show which goes out on Sky 201 and Freesat 403 every Friday from 6 p.m. So until next time, thanks for listening.